The game plan for today is to talk a little bit more about the Collisionless-Boltzmann equation and to talk about distribution functions, that is to say, the distribution of velocities in stellar systems. And the reason for this is twofold. One is that when we talk about the Boltzmann equation, this is our connection with theoretical physics, in particular statistical mechanics. And the second, when we talk about distribution functions, this is our connection with the observations. Because after all, it is mostly the photometry of a galaxy and the radial velocities that tell us in an instant what the structure of such a system is. We'll get to talk about the observations later on today, and as you will see, I will then make a lot of play about the fact that the photometry is in a spatial direction that is perpendicular to what the velocities tell us. I mean, after all, we see a galaxy projected in the sky, and the Doppler effect that tells us how fast things are moving is in the direction of the line of sight, which is perpendicular to the direction of the sky. This is a difficulty that has been plaguing astronomy ever since its beginnings, but I'll be talking about this in a moment. The way out, of course, is to restrict yourself to very symmetrical systems. After all, if you already know that the stellar system that you are looking at is spherically symmetric, it doesn't really matter that the projection in this direction is perpendicular to the line of sight in the other direction. All right, because the thing is symmetric, it shouldn't really matter. In a realistic situation, however, this is definitely not the case. And I will demonstrate to you with my little piece of computer code a few rather dramatic cases in which you can immediately see how difficult these things can be, for the very good reason that for most stellar systems, there can be velocity substructures, but they're extremely long-lived as compared with, for instance, the orbital lifetime, the orbital timescale of the system as a whole. Now, connecting back then to the theoretical part, what one could hope to do is approach things from both sides. And this is, in fact, what is being done in this trade most of the time. That is to say, our observational colleagues invent cleverer and cleverer ways of observing galaxies and stellar systems in great detail. And on the other hand, the model makers and the people working on the statistical mechanics of such systems approach it from the other side. Perhaps I should begin by reminding you yet again of the basics of this all, because it is seemingly simple, and you will again see this in other applications. In particular, you will see this in applications of gas dynamics, which is something that some of you may have to deal with. We effectively start with our distribution function, and that distribution function is the position, velocity, and time. Now, for later use, I'll refer to the fact that, in fact, these two coordinates, position and velocity, can be generalized. You can have a position coordinate and a momentum coordinate, for instance. So possibly also, you may want to remind yourself of the fact that there is a distribution of masses that is implicit in this whole description, right? Why this is important, we will possibly get to see later today, and certainly during some of the later lectures. Namely, it does make, in the long-term evolution of a stellar system, it does make a difference whether or not the mass of the particles is large or small, and whether or not the mass distribution function of the particle masses is broad or narrow. Right, so we already know from, just simply continuing on this mass distribution point a little bit, just looking ahead, we know, of course, from the theory of stellar structure that there is no such thing as a star that is more massive than 120 or so solar masses, the Eddington limit, because above that, the star would be blown up by its own radiation. On the lower hand, a normally radiating star that radiates because of hydrogen fusion in its core typically cannot have a mass smaller than, I think it's approximately 0.4 solar masses or 0.3 or something thereabouts, the red dwarfs. That may mean that you don't see these things, but from a stellar dynamics point of view, it may very well be that this mass distribution of stellar-like objects has a very, very long low mass tail. There is no a priori reason why the low mass tail of a stellar distribution, a stellar mass distribution, should not continue all the way to the mass of the moon or something thereabouts. From the point of view of the distribution function, this, of course, makes an enormous difference. And I think that you can already intuitively understand why that should be so. If you have a lot of bodies in a stellar system with a small mass, and for most ordinary distribution functions for mass, the total number per mass interval keeps increasing when you go to smaller masses. In other words, small things are more common than big things. That means that such a system has an immense number of degrees of freedom at the low mass end. Now, think again back to what you have learned in your thermodynamics classes. Thermodynamics is all a matter of equitably distributing things, such as energy, over degrees of freedom, where every degree of freedom has equal rights with every other degree of freedom. That is to say, if you have a very long low mass tail, these low mass objects could absorb an enormous amount of the orbital energy that is available to such a system. Right? And that makes a drastic difference from when they have a cutoff. Right? If you don't have any low mass objects to store your energy in, well, then, you know, that doesn't really make much difference. This, incidentally, is something that you will see back in various other theories of many particle systems, such as solid-state physics. Right. Well, now, for the moment, then, we will, having signaled that there is a problem under the surface here related to the mass distribution of the objects in the stellar system, in particular the stars, let us return now to this distribution function. And there, it doesn't really matter to me whether or not you use position and velocity or position and momentum. The book does it very, very carefully and very correctly, talking even slightly more about generalized coordinates, right? I mean, those of you who have had advanced classes in classical mechanics know what that is. For the moment, just in order to connect with what we actually observe and what we readily understand from daily life, I will keep referring to position and velocity, but you will understand that in an exact formulation, this should mean generalized coordinates and generalized momenta. Now, the previous time, I reminded you of the fact, and let me again reiterate this, that if we are interested in the time rate of change of any distribution, right, and this could be stars, it could be atoms in a gas, it could be anything that jolly well please, then you can write this formally by partially differentiating whatever it is that comes in here with respect to its degrees of freedom, with respect to its coordinates, right? In order to not clutter up the notation too very much, I will just omit the vector arrows here or the vector indices. So what you do is you say, well, I know that whatever I'm going to put in here that I'm going to differentiate is dependent on time. So what I do is I say I use a d by t by dt, d by dt, and then I put whatever is in here, I put also in there, plus whatever it is that changes in any other direction of which this is a functional. So you have, for instance, dx by dt, d by dx, or you have dv by dt, d by dv. And if there is more, you just add more. This is purely formal. I mean, just simply in differentiating in all possible directions of the mathematical landscape of whatever it is that you're going to put in here. Now, this is purely formal, and now where the physics comes in. To begin with, the physics comes in here that we stop at the velocity. Why do we do this? Because acceleration is a direct observable, and position and velocity are not. And I already reiterated to you that this is an insight that we owe to Christian Huygens already in the previous century. The next physics is that we have a prescription for this, for the acceleration. So dv by dt is an acceleration, and in here is where a lot of the model making and a lot of the difficulty is hidden. I'll be coming back to this in an instant. The x by dt, of course, we also know that's the velocity. And dt by dt is unity, so we can just simply remove that. And therefore, this is effectively what we end up with. And therefore, if we were to use this functional, this distribution function, we just complete the equation in the following fashion. And of course, if you want to put the vector notation back in, you will see that this is the inner product of a velocity and a gradient, and you will see that this is the inner product of this vector and this tensor over here. Well, now, I do this again deliberately in this way because, to my surprise, and this is one of the few points of criticism I have in the book does it precisely the other way around. If you look at what's written in equation 4.9 and 4.10, they start with this equation or something that is the same shape as this equation over here. And then they say, well, sorry, they end up with this equation over here, having given this part in what, to my mind, is completely circuitous way. Right, I mean, this bit is straightforward, right? I mean, it is not even necessary to memorize it, you already know it. Well then, what should be noted, however, is that this is not necessarily equal to zero, right? The time rate of change in the distribution function is prescribed by a collision term. And that is the second bit of difficulty that comes in, and that is also where an important part of this mass distribution of the partaking particles is being hidden. Now, what we should like to do is find out if there are good solutions to this particular equation. Right, and good, I mean, you start with a spatial distribution of points. From that spatial distribution of points, you compute the accelerations that the particles undergo. And then you try and find out if there's an equilibrium distribution of this type. This has turned out to be possible only in very, very special and restricted cases. Restricted mostly in the form of spatial restrictions, such as spherically symmetric systems, and restrictions in the things like the mass distribution here. For instance, that you say all the masses are equal, right? well, the what we will do in the second part of today's lectures is that we will also be talking about other quantities that can be derived from this. In particular, we will be talking about the observables. Now, there is a direct observable already in this equation, and that direct observable, of course, is the velocity. This is something that we can observe by means of the Doppler effect. The acceleration, under some circumstances, is observable. I'll get to be talking about that in an instant. Now, this, of course, is also spatially restricted because the velocity can only be directly observed in the radial direction by means of the Doppler effect, right? The second observable that exists to a certain extent, we have to be careful with this, is this mass distribution. As I think you will readily understand, this is only directly observable in the case that we can actually resolve the stellar system, right? And this is why our observational friends have been working so hard towards this goal. Because if you can observe the individual moving stars, not only can you observe the actual line spectrum of such a star, I mean, this velocity, by the way, can be observed by looking at the line broadening or something like that. It can also be seen for a collective effect. I mean, in that case, this velocity is not the velocity of an individual star, but is more similar to the wind speed in our atmosphere. The wind speed that we observe is the sum total of the organized velocity of all the gas molecules in the atmosphere. And still, the wind speed is something that we can observe. Similarly with the velocity here. But if we can resolve the stellar system, we can look at the individual velocities in the radial direction. Then, hopefully, we can also try to find out what the properties of these individual stars are, in particular what their masses are, right? And there is another observable which is perhaps not readily apparent from this equation, and that is the following. If we were to take the distribution function and we integrate it over all velocities, we get a density, a mass density, a particle density. As I already mentioned, this is a six dimensions in this symplectic space, three for spatial position and three for momentum or three for velocity. And therefore, if we integrate over all of velocity space, then we end up with something that describes the total number of particles in a given volume. All right. And that is a density. Now, usually we give this a mass density, which is the letter rho, mass density. I should really put it this way. Or you can simply use the integral f dv, and that is n, which is the particle density. That is a direct might be a direct observable. You would be tempted to think that this particle density or this mass density is a direct observable, but this is not necessarily the case. Of course, if you can resolve a stellar system, then the particle density should be a direct observable. But if you cannot, you just simply have a surface brightness of a galaxy. You have this smear of light in the sky, and you put your aperture or your photometer on there, and you say, I get so much light through so many square arc seconds. Right. That does not directly give you a mass density or a particle density, because the luminosity of various objects that you observe is a function of mass, and in fact a very steep function of mass. And therefore, this quantity here, which just simply on the analytic side, on the algebraic side, on the theoretical side, looks very nice and crisp or clear, it isn't so clear anymore because of the muddy fact that the luminosity is a very steep function of the mass, right? In other words, if you naively were to observe your properties of your distribution function by looking at the surface brightness of a galaxy, you would be very heavily biased towards the loud ones. You would be very heavily biased towards the high masses, which produce an enormous amount of light. I mean, a star that is only 100 times more massive than our sun emits of the order of 10 million times as much light. Right, so beware of this. The second reason that this is very tricky is related to what I have just described about this mass distribution that is also present in such a stellar system. You will be missing an enormous amount of small mass objects in this particular case. Those small mass objects, however, from the thermodynamic arguments that I have just given, do in fact absorb an enormous amount of energy in an equilibrium situation, right? and therefore, this might not be a very good guide to what you would actually want to know about a stellar system. Is the situation hopeless then? Well, it isn't, otherwise I wouldn't be standing here talking about stellar dynamics. But I hope that you will understand that there are many, many pitfalls here, and there are many things that are exceedingly difficult, and therefore one should be very cautious in jumping to conclusions in this particular case. Perhaps I should mention explicitly here that this is all the more important because we now know that a large fraction of the contents of our universe aren't even in here. Of course, I refer to the so-called dark stuff. That is present in stellar systems to approximately the 50% level, something like between a quarter and half of the mass of your typical stellar system, stellar galaxy, is made out of dark stuff. And even though it seems likely, we do not even know this for certain, even though it seems likely that that dark stuff does partake of this equation in the sense that it is also part and parcel of the distribution function over here, it is by no means directly observable, other than by its indirect effects on this acceleration over here. That's all we've got, right? Until further notice. Maybe you, in your career, will, you know, help to clarify the situation a little bit. But this is currently all we have. All right. On the other hand, life is not always unpleasant, and the opposite is also true. From what we have currently observed of the luminosity distribution and the velocity distribution, we have in fact concluded that there is dark stuff. And I think that you can already see on the blackboard here what the scheme of things is going to be. You observe the mass density or the particle density or whatever it is from the brightness distribution. So, for instance, for the surface brightness, the surface brightness of a stellar system, or another suitable form of photometry. Okay, just imagine the light or whatever it is. I have not even mentioned, because this is not a course in observational astronomy, I have not even mentioned that, of course, you can get help here from the spectral distribution. Okay, the way in which the brightness is distributed over the various colors. This does give you some extra information, all right, but I'm not going to talk about that in detail. You will hear enough about this when you hear about the structure of ordinary galaxies in another course. This you have. This, the velocity distribution, in particular the velocity distribution in the radial direction, you also have. And of course you expect, if both of these, the velocity distribution comes from F, okay, the velocity distribution and the density distribution are derived from the same distribution function F, you expect naturally that there is a consistency between these two. That these two should somehow jive, they should somehow correspond to one another, because they are, of course, integrated aspects, okay, integrated over velocity space here and integrated over spatial space over here. They are different aspects of the same distribution function. After all, this distribution function purportedly contains all there is to know about the way in which the stellar system is being built up. Barring, of course, again I must say, barring, of course, what we do not yet know about the mass distribution, but in any case. And now it turns out that if you do this, if you check for consistency between the surface brightness and the related mass density or particle density and the velocity distribution, that in many cases this does not really fit, this does not really jive, this doesn't really coincide properly. And it is precisely this that has led people to the supposition that there must be more to the galaxy than just what you see. And that is what has ultimately led to the indication of this dark stuff, right? And this, mind you, this is just a footnote, a historical footnote, as it were. This was already done long before people started to think about the difficulties in cosmology. All right, the presence of dark stuff in clusters of galaxies was first indicated in the 1930s by Fritz Zwicky, who found out that the velocity distribution in clusters of galaxies is much broader than what you would expect on the basis of the luminosity distribution of the galaxies. And he concluded that something like between 60 and 70% of the mass in a cluster of galaxies must be unseen stuff. Right? And in those days, people thought about dead stars and things, but it doesn't really matter. In the beginning, everybody thought Zwicky was crazy, which in a way he was, because he was a totally unpleasant gentleman. But in any case, that was the first indication. Then the second one is related to this very observatory. When Oort decided that when you look at the velocity distribution of the stars in the solar neighborhood, and there you're not really relying only on the radial velocities, but you can try and find a summary of the velocities of the stars in the solar neighborhood in all spatial directions, that didn't really jive with the mass density distribution of the same stars. And he found a number which we currently know as the Oort limit, which said that there must be more stuff in our galaxy than we actually see moving around us. And he came to something like of a factor of two or thereabouts. Now there again, this is in the 1950s. People could still think that our dark stuff was dead stars, right? Which are simply there. I mean, obviously there must be white dwarfs or something thereabouts. Currently, the numbers vary a little bit, but it is something of the order of between 20, 30, 50, 50% for an individual galaxy. I thought it would be appropriate to put this all in one blackboard, right? Because effectively what we will be dealing with in the remainder of the lecture series is going to be related closely to what is summarized over here. Right? We will be talking about the observations, okay, of these various circled objects. We will not be talking very much about this mass distribution stuff, except that I will demonstrate to you later on in these lectures, or at least, of course, it's in the book, that the high-mass objects separate out from the low-mass objects in a stellar system for very straightforward reasons. What remains now to be done is to see whether or not we can find stellar systems that at least approximate a reasonable solution to this equation over here, in the case of a collisionless stellar system, or in the case where collisions have been in the past so effective that they have led to a more or less equilibrium distribution. That is to say, as already indicated again and again, a distribution the lifetime of which is long as compared with the characteristic orbital timescale of the orbital structure of such a system. Then after that, we'll, of course, have to come back to this collision term over here. And that is the final part of my qualitative... excuse me. That is the final part of my qualitative overview this morning. The point is that this collision term over here, in the case of an n-body self-gravitating system, can be exceedingly complicated. The very first thing you think about in terms of the collisions is the following. Let us consider what the fate would be in the orbit of a single star in our stellar system. And with a collision term, I mean effectively something that gives rise to an acceleration over here. Now, you might say, why have this separate then, right? Well, the reason is that you can give a statistical expression for this collision term, whereas technically speaking, when you write down this distribution in this form over here, this acceleration is the individual acceleration of an individual particle. Right. Now, I must admit that this is woolly. Okay, this is a little bit sort of mixing things up. All right. And the reason for this effectively is already hidden. And again, I must reiterate this. Perhaps this might have escaped your attention. This is again implicit in the original form of this distribution function, because what we have done is we have divided space in one given direction and velocity in another direction, and we have said F is the total number in such a small box, which means that by defining a distribution function, we have already renounced the use of individual particle orbits. We have already said, and I mentioned this to you when we were introducing first this distribution function, I had already said that by taking this, we hope and expect that there can be a cell size in position velocity space, which is so large that it contains a substantial number of particles, and substantial I mean that it is so large that the RMS deviations over there, just a scatter, right, the square root deviations, are smallish. And that, on the other hand, it is so small that you do not have sufficient, appreciable gradients throughout such a box. Okay, it's big enough that there are many particles, and it is small enough that you don't have any structure inside. All right. I mean, the technical term for this is a subgrid model. That being so, by using a distribution function, we have already renounced on following the individual orbits. On the other hand, we know that the distribution function is, of course, made up of the individual orbits, which is why this acceleration comes in here. Now, when we go and look at this collision term over here, this collision term is directly related, is direct driver, as it were. This collision is a direct driver of the time rate of change of the distribution function, right? And therefore, this collision term, in a way, is a statistical average, because this F is already a statistical average. On the other hand, you may ask yourself, is this justified for an n-body system? And this is an important point that I want to emphasize again in a little bit more detail right now. You might think that a collision term could be seen, for instance, as an interaction between an individual orbit of an individual star and an overall potential. An overall potential that is due to the space, to the velocity average, this distribution here, of the stellar system. Obviously, if you have such a distribution, if you have a mass density, for instance, then from this, you can immediately derive the gravitational potential. And this is something that we had already been discussing before. So this is F that generates gravitational potential, and the gravitational potential in its turn generates the accelerations over here by a straight derivative. So if you have this gravitational potential over here, now the stellar orbit over there, you might even consider this a collision. Now, technically speaking, this is not taken into account in this way, right? Because the interaction between an individual particle and its potential has already been taken account of in F itself, right? So that's, even though conceptually, all right, it is an interaction, we don't really mean it this way. No, I'll put this in brackets because this is already in the distribution of F. But there is another one. For instance, you can have a star coming in here, And you can have another star coming in there. And then they interact in the following fashion. Right. And this you could properly call a collision. All right. Now, we know from the solution of the Kepler problem that this is a purely conservative interaction. Now, some of you who really like general relativity may say this is not necessarily so. Because if these stars pass sufficiently close to one another, simply due to gravitational radiation, you will already lose a little bit of orbital energy, which in the long term, this might influence the stellar system. Now, it turns out if you do the timescales over here, you end up for most stellar systems with something of the order of 10 to the 40 years or thereabouts. So even though it exists, it shouldn't really be very important. So since a two-body interaction over here is purely conservative, there again you might say that it could not possibly be a driver for the long-term evolution of this distribution function over here. Besides which, we had already renounced on this kind of thing, right? We hadn't really been talking about individual orbits. We had already said that we take the boxes in position velocity space so large that there is oodles of stars in there, billions and billions, Carl Sagan would say. And that means that you just simply take the overall behavior of this sort, and because momentum and energy and angular momentum and stuff are conserved in a two-body interaction, it makes no difference. It just averages out. So there again, this kind of interaction is unimportant as a driver and does not occur in this collision term over here. But now, there is a third one, and that is really the cruncher. Suppose that I do not have the interaction between a particle and its overall potential generated by all the particles. Suppose that I do not have an interaction between two particles over here, because we already know that's conservative. No. I have a binary star over here. All right, with a large mass and a small mass and a large mass over here that orbit merrily around. And then another star comes down by. Now, when we look at the overall distribution over the entire system, then, of course, because you have made it this way, mass and energy and momentum and angular momentum and all the other good stuff are conserved. Because, after all, this is a purely straightforward mechanical system with only these two as independent coordinates. However, when we look at upon this as a three-body system, then there is no longer conservation between the two bodies over here and the third body going by. For instance, it is perfectly possible, and indeed Portugis Swart and his people are sort of specialists in this kind of trade, it is perfectly possible that this star comes by over here, and after some brouhaha, after some initial to-do, it goes off in another orbit, and it has then stolen one of those two stars, right? So it can have a sort of partner exchange, as it were, over here. And this grossly violates most of the suppositions that we have been taking so far in this particle distribution function. And indeed, it is processes of this type that make not only these collision terms very, very complex, but also undermine the whole idea of setting things up in a statistical fashion. Right? These things, these occurrences here, do not average out to a very nice, simple kind of distribution. In fact, theoretically speaking, just a single binary in a galaxy consisting of 100 billion stars could determine the fate of the entire system. Right. Now, you may wonder, where does the difference lie? Right. And it turns out, and we'll be coming to talk about this later, it turns out that the difference is made by those binaries God can effectively resist the exchange that I have been talking about here. So rather than having a situation that is sketched over here, you would have a situation in which the outgoing star remains an outgoing star, but with a different direction, a different energy, and a different angular momentum that it started with. And the binary has now become tighter, has become harder. The binding energy that thereby has been liberated has been given to this other star, because overall, of course, there's conservation, right? So once you have a hard binary, and what hard means in this case, we'll get to be talking about, right? It gets harder and harder and harder and serves as a source of energy, an unlimited source of energy to the rest of the system. And when I say unlimited, is if you have two point masses orbiting here, they could be arbitrarily close together, and therefore they could generate an arbitrarily large amount of energy to give to the entire stellar system. Now, of course, you know that this cannot be correct. Stars aren't point particles. Stars are finite size. So there will be a certain lower limit to this. But given the fact that in your typical stellar system, the star-to-star distance is so very, 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 very large, 40 million stellar diameters in the solar neighborhood, that means there's a long way to go before you finally end up in a special situation when the stars get to touch or exchange mass or something of that general sort. Okay. Now, I hope from this summary that you realize that even though this expression here looks theoretically very nice and clean and pretty, all right, from a practical point of view, it is a more or less unmanageable thing. I'm going to do two things. One is we're going to be following the book in still talking a little bit more about the behavior of this distribution function in certain special nice cases to give you some impression as to what it will look like. And then I'm going to illustrate some special cases of this, again, by means of my computer code that will give you some direct tangible insight into how these things develop. It is then thereafter that we'll make the jump to what we started out with in the moment ago. We're going to be talking about observables that could possibly constrain our search for good models of stellar systems.